To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good morning, and welcome to Labor Radio. Of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm Jamie Partridge, your host. And today we have Ellen David Friedman, a longtime union organizer and author of many articles, chair of the Labor Notes Board, and now coming out with her first book, Keep Going, A Guide to Organizing When It's Hard. Welcome, Ellen.
Well, good morning, Jamie. Delightful to see you.
Ellen's organizing skills are legendary. Ellen is a retired organizer with the National Education Association in Vermont and a founder, along with Bernie Sanders, of the Progressive Party there. And currently, Ellen facilitates the United Caucuses of Rank and File Educators, UCOR, a national network of progressive teacher union caucuses. So, full disclosure, I invited Ellen on the show to promote her book and to promote the DSA Labor Study Group for Sunday evenings starting April 1st on the same book. So, Ellen, the title of Keep Going, like subtitle of Keep Going, is A Guide to Organizing When It's Hard. And you appeal to our sense of frustration when co-workers get scared, meetings flop, committees crack, leaders disappoint, helping us to get back up, dust ourselves off, and figure out the next step. And you give concrete examples from many different unions and campaigns. So your introduction outlines your own journey to becoming a lifelong labor organizer. How do workers get to that attitude adjustment, to that place of understanding, honoring, and committing to a life of organizing?
You know, I think that the path, if you're going to stay in the movement for a long time, will obviously be completely different for every person. Because what we come with, our life experience, the values that we inherited growing up, what was happening in our work lives, our education, relationships to people in our communities and so on, tremendously varied. And really one of the major points that I have learned in a lifetime of organizing and try and make in this book is that an absolutely necessary ingredient, if we are going to keep going over time, is a form of kind of radical self-respect. That we have to be able to look at our own experiences as the best form of teaching we can ever get, to give up the idea that there is some single model, what should an organizer look like, what should they be, how should they act, is really not very grounded in reality. And instead, if we take it upon ourselves to just look with great love, compassion, respect, and of course, a critical eye to seeing, you know, how can we always sharpen up, then it's possible to get through the infinite number of disappointments, despair, despairing circumstances, and really horrible tragedies that we try and encounter every day. So that's a very important element, I think.
Wonderful. So your book starts with some short teasers. When your union breaks your heart, more talk, more action, make more organizers, find the small victories. So summarize some of these teasers for us.
Yeah, I think the way in which this all fits together for me is in the following kind of logic. We build a movement not only by sheer numbers. For example, we have seen this growing phenomena, of course, since the Trump 2 administration, of many millions of people turning out in marches. In fact, today, March 28th, there's going to be another No Kings rally and march, thousands of them around the country. So putting thousands of people on the street or millions of people on the street is essential in our movement. But what I actually think is perhaps even more essential is, what are we doing day by day by day, minute by minute, hour by hour, in our workplaces, or if we are retired or unemployed, not in a workplace? We can and must be finding ways to behave like organizers in a very steady, ongoing basis. And the difference between thinking of yourself as an organizer and thinking of yourself as someone who will, you know, go out in a big demonstration is that you look around and take responsibility for thinking through what can be done at this moment, not a fantasy about what we would like to see happen, not an endless litany of how terrible things are and how disappointed we are and how angry we are, but instead, at this moment, given the resources around me, what is it I can do to help build collective capacity? In short, how can I stay as an organizer, and how can I help more people around me become organizers? And when that happens, we're not only mobilizing people in large numbers, but we are building capacity to take on the insults of capitalism every day, wherever we see them. So those first mentions that I offer in the book are to keep uppermost for us, that our task really is to help ourselves and other people become and stay as organizers throughout our lives.
So your book is not about the mechanics of organizing, as we can get that in the Labor Notes book and training called Secrets of a Successful Organizer. This book helps you and your fellow organizers develop a rock-solid foundation, an analysis, and a set of values you can rely on as you move forward. Tell us about the four principles of organizers that you develop in the first part of the book. Cultivate respect, organize democratically, stay grounded in reality, and stay steady.
Yes, well, I've already alluded to one of the principles that I consider to be the most important, which is to cultivate respect for oneself. But very closely connected to that is the principle of cultivating respect for others around us. And what I mean by this is it is not really an emotional state. It is a recognition of the structural connections that we have to one another as workers under conditions of capitalism, which is, we find ourselves really from the moment we are through with our education, or sometimes very often, in fact, before we finish our education, needing to go to work. We need to go to work because capitalism requires that we sell our labor. And so there is a coercive reality that we are all stuck in until we change the system, until we help end this coercive and punitive and degrading system of capitalism. Our only choice really is to find ways to behave within it that offer constant resistance to it. And one of those is to respect each other as workers, because by definition, the employer does not. Now, the employer, of course, may treat people, call them associates, try and lull them into thinking that they are valued, that their opinion matters, that they may even have some say over the conditions of their employment. But of course, the reality is the job of management, the job of capitalism, is to control workers. And so I consider this attitude of respect for others to be very, quite revolutionary, actually, and an essential quality to remember. Quite closely related to that, needless to say, is that our organizing must have a democratic character. It is always only too easy to mimic and recreate the patterns that capitalism has enforced on us. And those are hierarchy, you know, concentration of knowledge and expertise and decision making, not to mention power and wealth at the top of the hierarchy. So our organizing can't look like that. It has to look like the opposite of that. So a form of really deeply ingrained participatory democracy is what I believe should infuse our actions. And so I talk about that. And then, you know, these principles of staying grounded in reality really mean we cannot let our horror and anger and anxiety about all the horrible things we see, we cannot permit that to get us destabilized and lose track of the actual power we possess, which unfortunately now is relatively small. Our labor movement, as we know numerically, is tiny. Public sector, somewhere in the 30-32% range, unionization, and private sector, 7% unionized. So structurally, our power is still very limited through the labor movement. However, as we know, those of us, especially of our generation, Jamie, we know that there is a movement afoot in what people see, what they value, and what they are seeking. There has not been this much inclination, impetus, and movement towards collective action by workers for 50 years, you know, not since the 1970s. We know it is going to be incredibly difficult for most workers to achieve a union because, you know, the bosses break the law all the time. They make it almost impossible to form a union. And yet, collective power of labor does not just depend on the National Labor Relations Act or the National Labor Relations Board. It depends on our willingness to behave collectively. But I really think we should keep our goals very connected to our power, to our true assessment of power, and not have fantasies about what we're capable of, but instead build slowly and methodically. So those are some of the points I'm trying to draw out there.
Amen.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Labor Radio on KBOO Portland. Our guest has been Ellen David Friedman, the author of Keep Going, A Guide to Organizing When It's Hard. If you find this useful, please consider contributing to KBOO, listener-supported, community-sponsored, non-corporate radio at kboo.fm and make a donation.
Well, so part two lifts up four ingredients of successful organizing. Help your workers, your co-workers, understand power in the workplace. Overcome division and come together around common concerns. Overcome fear and take collective action. Reflect on the changing balance of power and keep going. So talk with us about these four ingredients.
Yeah, well, this has become, these four things have become my entire curriculum for organizing. So I do a lot of labor education, training, strategy work with organizers, with rank and file members, elected leaders. I have been doing so my whole career for 50 years in the movement, but in retirement, which has been actually a rather long time by now, primarily through labor notes, is an effort, really, in many ways, for me to unlearn what I did as an organizer and labor educator in the early decades of my work in the movement. And frankly, to try and unlearn some of the practices that are very prevalent in our movement. So, for example, the idea that that there's a template for organizing. And if we just sort of follow step by step, and we do our one-on-one conversations, and we map our workplaces, and we do our structure tests, and we build escalating actions, you know, to pressure the employer, that's all there is to it. All of those things, of course, must be done. They do have to figure in our work. But underneath that, there are many, many challenges, shall we say, that are, first of all, that we experience ourselves internally, that we experience in our interaction with others. There are conflicts between people in our workplaces and in our unions. There are definitely conflicting sets of values and ideas about strategy and so on. And it is not to mention how often we are heartbroken by the officers and bureaucrats in our union. And so I have really spent much of the last 20 years thinking through and trying to arrive at a way of helping people face those, because they're quite real, not be defeated by them, and figure out how to keep going in the more, how shall we say, human aspects of organizing. So in that process, what I found was that I really only need four principles or sort of aspects of a framework to keep myself straight all the time. And I refer to them as the four tasks of organizers. And as you have mentioned them, the first is that as organizers, we can help our coworkers understand the relations of power in the workplace and understand the relations of power in our union. Talk about them, think them through together, demystify them, make them transparent, and help people get a sense of mastery of the world that they are embedded in. The second is to help our coworkers overcome divisions in order to form groups that are capable of feeling like a group, thinking like a group, and acting like a group, which means we have to seriously face the divisions, of which there are innumerable, a myriad of innumerable divisions, race, gender, age, sexual identification, ethnicity, language, also things like job title, seniority, cultural backgrounds, cultural norms, political differences, habits, attitudes. So the divisions are always there. And what I've learned is that it's not so much talking about the divisions and learning to, you know, love everybody that you work with. You won't. But instead to find out, is there a point of unity? Is there something that could bring any number of your coworkers together in a group, either formal, perhaps a committee, a contract action team, a bargaining team, a stewards council, you know, any other kind of committee you might have, a women's caucus, something like that, or informal groups, you know, we're second shift in this, you know, commercial bakery, and three out of the four ovens that we're supposed to be using for, you know, 12-hour shifts haven't been working well for the last 6 months, you know, what are we going to do about that? So there are some steps we can take to help people feel like they are part of a group around a shared goal. The third thing we do as organizers is help people overcome fear so we can take collective action together. Obviously, fear is at the heart of the employment relationship for all of us. So I talk at length about that, and a lot in this book concentrates on that. And then the final thing that I think we can do as organizers, which we rarely do enough, is to help our coworkers reflect and keep going. And the reflection is pretty critical. Not only oh, we were just in a contract battle, you know, what did we win? And did we get that last 0.7% we were trying to get, you know, or push back the premium increase the employer was trying to force on us in healthcare. But actually to look at how we changed, to see how people who started out cynical are now somewhat less cynical and more willing to participate. Or, you know, the people that said, I never have any time, I don't have time, don't ask me to come to meetings because I'm not going to, because I've got, you know, I'm a single parent and I have three jobs and I can't, transportation is impossible for me. That's true. Those are real things for people. And yet, what I have found is that if we do our organizing with this tremendous attitude of respect, of helping people feel like they are part of a group, of taking action on meaningful things, which may be small, that, well, lo and behold, people are making time for these things. And when we reflect on that, we can then say, we need that, right? We need people to give their time to the movement. So let's remember, let's think about how that happened. It wasn't by magic. It wasn't because we coerced people to do it. Was because we went through a process. So anyway, those are the four things I think we can always do as organizers.
Great. Well, the part three of your book explores the notion of getting unstuck. How does the book help us get unstuck?
Well, we get stuck all the time. It is something, if we look at our own lives, we know it. And when we, you know, become, again, like you and me, Jamie, sort of old enough and we're still in the movement, we find ourselves often kind of mentoring other people in the movement. And I'm sure you, like I, have people coming to me not infrequently saying, I can't figure out what should happen next. And after many, many years of listening to these examples and stories and helping people think through what they know, what their own experience has taught them, I've identified in this chapter a number of things that seem to come up pretty commonly, and then just offer back the experience of what our movement has shown and produced over all these years. And again, I just want to mention here that I have been so incredibly lucky to be close to the Labor Notes Project for almost its entire life. I'm not a founding member. I'm a little younger than the founders. But ever since I became an organizer, Labor Notes was the magazine in my mailbox in rural Vermont. It's all sometimes all I could get, but I would get that once a month. And it really did help me keep going. And the reason is because that's what we do in our publications and our books and our conferences and troublemaker schools and all of the consultations that we do, is we reflect back what the movement has taught us. Oh, you're facing this problem. There was this group of, you know, grocery workers in Indiana. They had a problem just like this 2 years ago. Here's an article about what they did. I'll put you in touch with the, you know, the woman who was the president at the time, like led this really interesting campaign. So everything really in this book comes from that wellspring of knowledge and experience. That's why Labor Notes is such a precious gift to our movement. Anyway, I can't talk about all of them, of course, but I'll offer one, which is people do often get stuck around shame. And this happens all the time in workplaces, in part because our bosses use it. They use it to try and keep us fearful, self-doubting, and isolated from one another. So it can be very obvious, being targeted by a supervisor or a manager and bullied in various ways, made to feel like your work is inadequate, you're too slow, you're too stupid, you do the wrong things, you mess things up for your coworkers. You know, it can be being shouted at, being belittled and demeaned in the workplace, or it can be much subtler than that. you know, being pulled aside and said, you're really not meeting, you know, the metrics, and I've noticed, and if it's, you know, you can't pull this together, we're gonna have to put you on a performance improvement plan. And so they use those tactics, but the problem is we can't change that, right? We don't get to change the bosses and what the bosses do. Excuse me. We don't get to change it unless we organize and fight the bosses. But they're gonna do what they're gonna do. It is their job to try and bully us. One thing we can control, and I'm always emphasizing, let's remember those things we can control are some of our attitudinal or, you know, intellectual ways of dealing with what they do to us. So they try and inflict shame, but we do not have to accept that gift of shame. We can say no to it. We say, no, whatever you do to me, you're not going to make me ashamed. And there is a way to achieve that. So a simple example is every time someone comes to me and says, oh no, I've been branded as a troublemaker in my workplace, I say, ah, time for the medal to pin on your chest, you know, a proud troublemaker. That's exactly what you're there to do. You were there to make trouble for the boss and their system of oppression. So that's a tiny example. There are many other examples, some of which I cite in the book, some of which people will know. One of my favorite ones is I was working with a young woman many years ago, well, some years ago by now, who was a model worker, praised by the boss, outstanding, respected by her coworkers, but she knew things needed to be different, and so she organized a union in her workplace. And lo and behold, got a terrible performance evaluation after that. Unfortunately, she became ashamed. She didn't tell anyone. She started to really withdraw. She doubted that her coworkers were going to respect her anymore. She thought she might get fired. Thank goodness, she was in a union at that point. We had a relationship. I said, look, I did what organizers do. I said, this is part of the balance of power. Of course, the boss is trying to make you feel defeated. You've just organized a union under his nose. Naturally, it's what he's going to do. Eventually, she took her evaluation and she posted it online in the chat with her coworkers so everyone could see it. And she said, you know, please, any responses? And so, what did the coworkers do? They began posting their evaluations. Sure enough, the boss was cutting and pasting some of what he had put in hers and other people's. They started doing like taking red pens to the evaluations and saying, look how terrible his grammar is. He can't even spell. This isn't logical. And they turned this experience of isolation and shame into one of group identity and strength. So that's an example there.
An example of getting unstuck.
Yeah.
So, part four, the last part, is titled Think Again. It covers some common organizing practices you may have learned and proposes you rethink them. You want to walk us through some of those?
Yeah, I suspect we don't have a lot of time left, so I'll just maybe choose one or two. But let me choose one that has become a recent favorite for me. Which is the idea of confidentiality within our union practices. And so I began working as an organizer in the 1970s, and it was absolutely understood, for example, that collective bargaining was done behind closed doors. You elected a bargaining team and then sent them off, and at some point, they might issue you an update that says, we've been discussing Article 7, Section 2, and making some progress. You know, you get those kind of reports. And that was not true in every union. It was not true in every sector, but it was the norm. And beginning at least 10 years ago, maybe longer than that, thank goodness. Some of us militants in the labor movement really began setting our sights on that. and understanding that the use of secrecy or confidentiality, it's a boss's tool. It is not useful for us on the side of labor. What is useful for us on the labor side is openness, is transparency, is the free exchange of information, is, again, the trust and respect among our coworkers that, yeah, we can all understand the conditions of our own employment. We can understand these complicated, arcane things like, you know, salary schedules and shift differentials and, you know, job nuanced job titles and health insurance policies and pensions and, right? We can and we must. And that doesn't mean that everybody becomes, you know, a mini lawyer on the shop floor. First of all, we don't need that many lawyers. But by opening up the process, so what we call open bargaining, but I like to say opening up bargaining because it has so many different ways in which it can be opened up. We change the balance of power, as we know, because information is power. And we also change the capacity to build power among coworkers because now you are not relying on a few experts going in behind closed doors somewhere, making the decisions that are going to affect your life day in and day out. But you begin to collectivize the knowledge and the decision making and the ultimate authority of the union. So I talk at many instances in the book. And in real life, when I'm working with unions, I talk a lot about assess where you are presently in bargaining. What are the aspects of it that can be opened up? Sometimes it's a long process, step by step. But that is one example of unlearning what is considered to be kind of a sacred cow for many unions.
Great. Well, so do you have any final thoughts for our Labor Radio audience before we sign off?
I do. I would say to anyone who is currently in or coming into the labor movement, especially to younger workers, you are in an important slipstream of history right now. It is not every moment of history where we find these currents of militant democratic unionism coming to the surface. The last time really was the 1960s and 70s. We are in that moment again now. We have been since the last financial crisis of 2008. So that means if you look around, you're going to find people who are thinking what you think. You're going to find people who are really pissed off, but you can help them move past anger and into purposeful activity. We'll find people who are absolutely outraged and dumbfounded by all the inequalities that they see in their lives every day. And you can help them move past despair and into purposeful action. Because to build a movement, we don't need only the bad things that are being done to us, but we need people who are willing to think, to act collectively, to build democratic institutions like unions and infrastructure, and to wield those as weapons against the bosses and the system of bossism, which is capitalism. So it's a good moment to do that, and I hope you'll keep going.
Thank you, Ellen. So good listeners, now that you're ready to buy that book, go to LaborNotes website, labornotes.org, and order it, and consider joining the DSA book study by emailing portlanddsalabor@gmail.com. And that wraps it up for this episode of Labor Radio. We've been speaking with Ellen David Friedman, labor organizer and author of the just-released Keep Going, A Guide to Organizing When It's Hard. I'm Jamie Partridge, your host, and Labor Radio is broadcast this Monday and every Monday at 6 p.m. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.